To understand what life is going on this planet, we need to look deep into its past, back to where it all began. For example, ancient rocks reveal how Earth's fiery geology became habitable.
You'll find sitting on some of these lava flows, algal mounds, which we call stromatolites, which are basically where life is sort of thriving, growing on the volcanic lavas.
While tablets with early symbolic writing provide a glimpse into our emerging cognitive appetites.
Almost everyone would agree these are intentional, and they are some kind of information system.
As scientists uncover clues of our formative beginnings, they're discovering that some are surprisingly older than we thought. Even a recently extracted Antarctic ice core has prompted them to revise their dates back by millions of years. So how does understanding these venerable objects challenge our assumptions and have us rethinking our very place on this planet? I'm Molly Bentley, and we're learning from our elders on this episode of Big Picture Science as we go old school. Imagine discovering a box of handwritten letters tucked away in your closet. Paging through them reveals correspondence going back decades, and as you read them, emotions come flooding back about past thoughts and life-shaping adventures. Well, there's good reason for that. Writing is such a powerful form of human expression that its development is considered an inflection point in human evolution. And now scientists think that writing began tens of thousands of years earlier than once thought. If you turn one of your letters upside down, your friend's legible handwriting may now look like unintelligible chicken scratch. Indeed, the earliest writing, called proto-writing, resembles something similar to our modern eyes. Yet the 40,000-year-old collection of marks, dashes, and dots in bone, recently analyzed by researchers, are surprisingly complex. This symbolic writing would evolve into other written languages, and it's thought to have been done by Paleolithic hunter-gatherers, suggesting that they were more intelligent than the caveman stereotype. Hugh Grocott from the University of Malta told science reporter and contributor to the BBC Roland Pease he's excited by this new research.
You know, as a topic, language and writing are inherently challenging. And both myself and many of my friends, we wrote undergraduate theses about the evolution of language and rapidly kind of wished we hadn't. And, you know, it's famously challenging to understand these sorts of topics. You know, what do we mean by writing is not self-evident. And I think a broader understanding of language is more useful. And I think if with this broader definition, looking at things like these Paleolithic information systems in a fresh light is bringing new perspectives. But I think it's not bad to be wrong for the right reason sometimes, if that is the case, you know.
you talk of them as Paleolithic information systems. I mean, in the first instance, these are archaeological objects. There's a little hand-sized sculptures and so on, I think.
Yeah, so, you know, the human story in Europe is in many ways quite a late one. So our story is really focused in places like Africa. But about 45,000 years ago, our species spreads into Europe. And soon afterwards, there's the last ice age, or the last glacial maximum, to use, you know, the technical term. And this period sees a kind of proliferation of art and symbolism. And one part of this are these sort of small figurines, decorated bones, even things like spear throwers, which are a kind of handle you attach a spear to. So these are often, you know, a mixture of day-to-day objects, decorated and seemingly purely kind of artistic objects made from things like ivory. And sometimes, as the paper shows some lovely examples, these things are sort of intensely covered in small engravings. I think decoration is a good word, but again, a lot of this comes down to terminology. What do you mean by writing and art? And
So one of them looks a bit like an elephant or something.
It is. So often they're depicting animals, or often there are, you know, anthropogenic sort of hybrid animals and humans, this kind of thing, yeah.
Yeah. And how are they preserved? Why this particular part of Europe? Do you know any of that?
Well, it's a very good question, because I think it's partly because there is a genuine sort of effervescence of human culture. So people, I like to use the expression ice age hysteria. People are panicking. So there is a genuine abundance, I think. But also it's the fact that archaeologists have spent an awful lot of time working in places like Europe, as opposed to places like Asia and Africa. And that is perhaps biasing us.
So you have these figurines, but they sort of just feel like artworks to me, in a sense.
Yes,
very primitive
I think
artworks.
So. With the caveat that art is another of these terms, which is very hard to define, really. But yes, I think so. And I think probably we're looking at the tip of the iceberg in terms of, I think our species is by definition a symbolic species. We can imagine the Stone Age world with people were probably decorating trees and cliffs and their bodies, but very little of it preserves. But hard materials like bone and ivory, in the right circumstances, can just preserve. So this question of preservation, I think, is really key. And when we think about things like writing, you know, it's interesting that the early records of writing are on these hard materials. So the classic Mesopotamian examples are things like clay tablets. Now we're talking about these European, you know, ivory and bone and so on. But what about like softer materials and you know, simple papyri?
Don't, you're making me weep. No, absolutely. You can imagine maybe some smudges on a piece of tree bark or something that were passed around. I mean, these, just to be specific then, you have these sort of figurines as you describe them, and some of them I think are little tubes which may have been flutes and stuff, but the important part of this paper are these sort of scratches on them, sort of crosses and notches and dots, and they look deliberate.
Absolutely. You know, and archaeologists have known about these sort of decorated objects for, you know, at least a century, and it's been a long debate, and I think almost everyone would agree these are intentional. And they are some kind of information system. The point is then I think we can imagine a spectrum of what that means. So, you know, at the one end, it's something very simple, like a counting tally, perhaps marking days or months, all the way through to a more complicated explanation, you know, where we are thinking more like writing, where they are encoding more complex information. But that on that spectrum, it depends what we mean by things like writing, you know?
Yeah. I mean, what this paper brings to it is this sort of mathematical approach, information theory, where, if I've got this right, they sort of show the rate at which these patterns repeated on different objects.
Yes, yes.
Shows something about the intentionality.
Yes, exactly. And again, you know, this doesn't prove that this is some kind of proto-writing, but what they are demonstrating is that these are not random marks. They're showing some kind of information in some kind of organized manner, which is analogous to simple writing systems.
I don't know if an analogy would be with Morse code, where dots and dashes are sort of pretty meaningless, but because we can hear if it's being played that there's some kind of order to it.
Potentially.
We could, even an alien could work out this is probably meaning
and
something.
The way we think about writing today tends to be that, you know, writing is a way of encoding either words or syllables or sounds. But it is, you know, crucial to emphasize that early writing, be it, you know, proto-cuneiform or hieroglyphics and so on, are pictographs. They are literal pictures of things in the world. And over time, they become more symbolic, more abstract. But at the beginning, they are pictures. And, you know, this opens, I think, a very interesting world of thought, that there are many examples in you know, what we call the Stone Age, where people have these different information systems. So personally, I think broadening a definition of things like writing helps us understand those changes.
I mean, in a funny way, we're going the opposite direction with things like emojis, where we've abandoned writing. We've gone straight back to symbols which represent a smiley face or a banana
and there is,
something.
You know, there is an innate power in the directness of an image, isn't there, as opposed to something very abstract.
but I suppose what's funny is these dots, you know, the examples they give in their paper, they don't look like they're counting anything. They don't look like they're... I can't infer any meaning, you know, six crosses next to each other doesn't mean anything. So I guess it's not obvious what was going on with these.
No, objects. It's challenging. But, you know, again, if you imagine the symbol that barber shops use, you know, the striped spinning colours.
Striped red, white pole.
Simple, or flags and things, right? Simple depictions can encode a lot of complex social information. You know, we don't have to be dealing with Dante and Shakespeare for it to be writing, you know? But yes, I agree. I mean, this is something simple, but I think there's a possibility that we don't understand the meaning of it.
I mean, I've got this lovely theory. Well, I call it lovely. I just love these, for example, these sort of little elephant or animal-like things to be actually a Stone Age version of a birthday card, and you give the object and the scratches are happy birthday, Og, or something like that. You know, just a way of sort of identifying a token that you've given to someone.
You're not convinced. You know, I think all options are open. Or things like, you know, some kind of group identifier. You know, different groups have particular symbols, and different groups maybe exchange objects, you know, to make alliances, this kind of thing.
Yeah, like tags or something like that. If we go back, I think you can go back about 3 million years, so that not even Homo sapiens, but some of our ancestor species were just using stone tools. So there's a sort of, there's a totally utilitarian thing of being able to use stones to, I don't know, pound, break up bits of meat and so on with. And then you sort of go forwards and we get this more symbolic thing. And I'm just sort of wondering what's going on with the human capacity to think over all those sort of thousands and millions of years, and how it's sort of captured in the archaeological record.
I mean, I think even with things like stone tools, you know, making stone tools is quite complicated. I mean, you know, I've spent about 8 hours a day for the last 20 years thinking about stone tools, looking at them, studying them. I'm pretty useless at making them. And what's interesting is that going back hundreds of thousands of years, not only are people making quite complex tools, but often they're also doing so in particular, like different regions. So we see a kind of regionalization of the archaeological record. And again, are stone tools just practical things? It's not always clear. You know, it's possible that sometimes they are making stone tools in a more symbolic way, I think. But of course, the challenge is things like language and cognition they don't fossilize or preserve. So we can only look indirectly at these sorts of clues. I mean, things like ochre. So ochre is, you know, iron oxide powder, which often is sort of very bright red. And again, going back hundreds of thousands of years, humans are selecting this bright red pigment and probably decorating their bodies with it and other objects. Again, is that symbolism? Is that something a bit different? You know, one concept archaeologists sometimes distinguish between is symbolism and more kind of iconic. So an icon is something which doesn't have a kind of abstract meaning, whereas symbolism has an abstract meaning. So it could be, you know, red means danger. You know, it's not. And so I think it's tricky. So it's some sort of information system, you know. So we see this picture where over, hundreds of thousands of years, humans gradually become more complex and a richer kind of artistic and symbolic life. And I think, you know, in the past, people have often looked for a sort of eureka moment when, you know, ape-like hominins suddenly become fully fledged humans. And that narrative of a sort of Paleolithic revolution is really deeply rooted. But in my opinion, and I think most of my colleagues, much of the way we think about these issues is really based on analogues with things like the Industrial Revolution. You know, this idea that big changes happen in a short time period in a particular place. I think the reality is things are spread across time and space.
I mean, as sort of the deeper question I'm quite interested in, is I'd sort of long imagined that you mentioned the Ice Age. So, you know, the humans lived through this 100,000 year period of ice from about 110,000 years ago to about 10,000 years ago. They sort of scraped out a living, and then the ice recedes, and then suddenly humanity gets uncorked. Not long after that, a few thousand years later, we start to see the first cities, and we see things like cuneiform being invented and so on. And it seems to me this is telling us that actually, you know, tens of thousands of years earlier, this was all sort of struggling to come out, or was actually was there, and we're just not seeing all of it.
Yeah, I mean, you know, to me, the big picture here is our changing views on, you know, how we understand the birth of things like civilization. Again, one of those words which are very commonly used, but very challenging. And the traditional idea is that, you know, civilization kind of suddenly appears with this combination of things like writing and cities and political complexity. But in my opinion, what the archaeological record shows across space and time is that all the things we're interested in come and go, and, you know, they appear in different forms. And this old story of like a sudden birth of civilization is really past its sell-by date, you know? So now we see, for example, very different types of cities and, you know, writing emerging in different settings. So that's the big picture to me, a much more kind of polycentric view on how humans have changed over time. And as you mentioned, a key part of this is climate. You know, how, so much of the human story is driven by the kind of rhythms of the natural climate change in the past. And it's, you know, the changes of the last 10,000 years, things like urbanization and so on, are really the tail end of a long, long story. And the more we learn, the more we realize how earlier humans were much more complex than we had understood before.
Thank you so much, Hugh Grocut, for talking to Big Picture Science.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Hugh Grocut is an archaeologist at the University of Malta. Roland, I know that you found this research particularly interesting. What are some of your takeaways after talking to Hugh?
For me, the key bit of all this is it just shows how much like ourselves our ancestors were, that it's not just about getting through from day to day, but it's being creative. So just the fact they had art, but and we've known that, but that sort of creative urge and trying to convey something to one another through creativity.
It's really humanizing. And
yeah.
And I like the idea that some of it is elusive, that they maybe have had a sense of humor or deep thoughts or abstract thoughts that we may never be able to figure out, but which reveal that their minds were more complex than we assumed.
And the other thing which is quite weird is that these signs go on for about 10,000 years and then they just disappear until modern civilizations start to arise, you know, much, much later. So what we could find if we looked elsewhere, now that we know that it's there, just, I'd love to know more.
Coming up, few mediums are as nice as ice for preserving records of the past.
Ice cores historically have told us a number of really important things about human impact on the Earth. They record the changes that happened over the Industrial Revolution and into the modern times.
Next, what reading that ancient ice cube can tell us about our changing climate as this episode of Big Picture Science continues to go old school. If you want to understand how our planet has changed over deep time, that is, over millions of years, having a time machine is handy. Here's how scientists create theirs out of a block of Antarctic ice.
Ice core drilling happens in lots of different ways. There are different methods. For us, we want to keep the ice cold, obviously, and we want to keep it intact. We use specialized drills that are something like, if you're a carpenter, there's something like a hole saw that can, you know, drill a hole in a door. But they're very specialized, and they cut down into the ice sheet and leave a cylinder behind, and anywhere from 1 to 3 or 4 meters long. And we break it off and pull it to the surface. And then we carefully line it up with the one before it. And then you put the drill back in the hole and drill some more over and over and over again.
This nearly 4 to 10 inch wide popsicle extracted from Antarctic ice, the result of slow accumulation of snow and trapped gas, offers scientists a pristine record of Earth's past climate. Now, we want to travel as far back in time as possible, of course, so scientists search for drill sites that will produce the oldest ice cores. And their hunt recently exceeded expectations when an Antarctic drilling expedition yielded cores not 3 million years old, but twice that, 6 million years old, the oldest ice cores on Earth.
The ice cores that we found that are really old are very close to the bottom of the ice sheet. I'm Ed Brook, and I'm a professor of Earth, Ocean, and Atmospheric Sciences at Oregon State University, and I study the history of Earth's atmosphere from ice cores.
His team spent nearly 6 weeks in East Antarctica camping and drilling in an area called the Allen Hills, where ancient ice has been well preserved. The field season was part of the National Science Foundation's Center for Oldest Ice Exploration, or COLDEX, a collaboration of more than a dozen research institutions led by Oregon State University. And as for what it's like to behold a sample of the oldest ice on the planet,
they look like most regular ice cores, except when you get right near the bottom, they start to pick up material from the glacier bed, so they start to look a little bit green or brown, depending on the sediment that's been incorporated. But otherwise, they look like a cylinder of ice that contains tiny air bubbles, and those air bubbles contain ancient air. And so the combination of the air bubbles and the ice make it look a little bit cloudy. But when you look closely, what you're seeing are just these little pockets of ancient air.
Air bubbles are direct samples of past atmosphere, while the ice records dust, aerosol chemistry, and surface temperature. Altogether, paleoclimatologist Ed Brook says it reveals Earth's climate millions of years ago and how it's changed.
Ice cores historically have told us a number of really important things about human impact on the Earth. They record the changes that happened over the Industrial Revolution and into the modern times where we measure these things directly now. The work that we're doing is going way, way back in time, much older than any other ice cores. And we're really interested in fundamental questions about kind of how the world works. How did the patterns of temperature change and ocean currents evolve over 6 million years? How does the Earth system respond when there are changes even in the position of continents when you go back that far? So there are lots of fundamental questions in Earth science that have been really not had complete answers for a while that we're hoping to address.
You mentioned the Industrial Revolution. It seems extraordinary to think about the Industrial Revolution unfolding up in Europe and America and then down in Antarctica. It's being recorded in the ice.
Yeah, ice cores from Antarctica tell us a lot about how things evolved since the 1700s. And there are also ice cores in Greenland, which are much closer to the action, so to speak, on those timescales. And together, they record all sorts of things. They tell us about how lead pollution evolved.
Why is that? Do deposits just find their way, they float down onto the ice and then they get trapped?
Yeah, the material is transported to the ice sheets in a variety of ways. So the gases in the atmosphere circulate around the Earth very quickly. So if you're measuring, say, carbon dioxide in Antarctica, you're getting a global picture of the carbon dioxide. Things like lead that are carried in fine, tiny, tiny particles by the wind get to the ice sheets in a more complicated way. But we can see big changes in those things starting in the 1700s and going forward in time.
Do you think that the ice cubes in our ice trays reflect the conditions in our kitchen and certainly in our water supply, but maybe not in our kitchen? Is that possible?
Well, they probably tell you something about your water supply, but ice that forms in the polar regions and that we study is actually very different than the ice cubes in your freezer. The way the ice that we study forms is that snow falls on the ice sheet, and it's cold, right, so it doesn't melt, and the snow just gets buried. And as it gets buried, the snowflakes recrystallize and compact, and they eventually, maybe 50 to 80 meters down below the surface, turn to solid ice. But there was air between the snowflakes, and that air ends up in bubbles. And it's not bubbles like bubbling through your soft drink. They're bubbles just form because of the way the ice compacts. So if you had this in your freezer, you could have a pretty cool cocktail party because the ice would look pretty different.
Well, what was surprising about reading about the extraction of this core is that the ice core was older than you thought it would be. And I'm wondering, why did you not know precisely how old it was going to be? And what does that say about the mysteries of the Antarctic ice sheet?
It's very hard to predict the age at the bottom of the ice sheet really anywhere. We understand some things about the way the ice flows and the way it forms. We can image it with radar. But normally, until we drill, we don't really know what we're going to get. Ice coring happens in a lot of different places. Out in the center of Greenland or Antarctica, we might be drilling 3,000 meters down, so, you know, a couple of miles. Around the edges of Antarctica where we're working and we find the oldest ice, we're drilling down a few hundred meters, so not quite as far, but still pretty significant. And it's because we're going deep in these complicated places, we can have pretty good educated guesses about the age at the bottom. You know, if you want older ice, there's some places you'll go versus other places. But to know exactly what you're going to get is actually quite difficult.
It must be a treat to go to one of the few places in the world, aside from the bottom of the ocean, that is a kind of, well, at least a desert from humanity, but that has remained pristine for thousands, maybe millions of years.
Yeah, it's been a real joy of my life to be able to go to these places. The landscape is really, the scale is just amazing. And to be lucky enough to go there and really see a landscape that hasn't, not only is it untouched really, also hasn't changed. I mean, you can walk on rock surfaces that probably haven't really changed in millions of years. And that is it's just not something you normally experience in your life. So it's a wonderful thing to do. Sometimes it's cold and windy and uncomfortable.
I've heard that about Antarctica, that it is cold. Well, let's talk about how you date these ice cores. And you use argon gas. What is it that measuring argon gas can tell you about the date of this ice?
There are lots of ways of dating ice cores, but with our cores, they're so old that some of the normal ways you would approach it don't work. We've been relying on a technique that's based on the measurement of a particular isotope of argon. Argon is a noble gas. It's not reactive. There's argon in the atmosphere. The amount of what's called argon-40 in the atmosphere has slowly been changing over geologic time. And it changes because the argon-40 comes from the decay of potassium-40. And potassium is a very common element in the Earth's crust. And as it decays, the argon leaks into the atmosphere. And we've calibrated the rate of change of this argon-40. And this is work done at Princeton University by my colleagues there. And the change is slow, but the measurement is very precise. And so all you have to do is measure the amount of argon-40 and you can figure out how old the air is.
One of the big reveals is what this core and the conditions of this core have revealed to scientists about the conditions of the Earth 6 million years ago. This is a two-part question. Is it challenging what we understood about the Earth 6 million years ago? Because, of course, we have some understanding of what the climate was like.
We're learning a lot. I mean, one thing we're learning is just about the presence of this ice. The ice sheet probably was near what its current configuration is 6 million years ago, based on the existence of the ice this old.
Meaning it's there. There was an ice sheet there.
Right.
That's answer number one.
And that's not surprising to people who study Antarctica. You know, we think the Antarctic ice sheet formed more than 30 million years ago. But to be able to dissect that a little bit more and have samples of actual ice from 6 and 5 and 4 million years ago tells us things. For example, we can determine what the temperature was like over that time period. And we actually see about a 12 degree centigrade cooling over that time period. And that's, it matches up sort of in trend pretty well with evidence from ocean sediments in other parts of the world. It's a little larger cooling than you see, say, in the tropics, and we're trying to sort out how much of that might be changes in the elevation of the ice sheet versus what people call polar amplification. Changes in the poles are bigger than they are in other parts of the world. We've been measuring gases that tell us about the temperature of the ocean. And so a record of the whole ocean temperature shows cooling over that time period. The patterns of that cooling are quite interesting. That's something that we're still working on getting published. We're measuring greenhouse gases like carbon dioxide and methane. And those are those data are very interesting. They'll be coming out in a paper quite soon in Nature. But the basic message is that we can see sort of long-term trends in atmospheric CO2. But I think we might have to wait for the paper to come out for the details.
Okay, that's a trailer, a bit of a preview. Yeah. But Ed, help us understand then these trends in climate variability. Because if someone is skeptical that we are in the midst of man-made or human-made climate change, they will often point to past records and say, see, it was colder. See, it was hotter then. But that is not the way to use these data and these conclusions. So how do we put the climate variability over millions of years, how does it help us understand what's happening now?
Yeah, I think one of the key things about the modern situation and probably the next couple of hundred years is that we're moving well outside of what we see in these ice core records, particularly the records that we have for the last million years, which are well developed and have a lot of detail associated with them. The modern atmosphere is very different. Greenhouse gases are much higher today than they have been over the last several million years. And the rate of change is very, very different than anything we've observed in the past records. So we're clearly in uncharted territory from that perspective. And I think that's an important message from the ice cores, and that's been an important message from the ice cores for quite a long time. In terms of, the broader spectrum of what this science is about, we want to have accurate predictions of the future, right? We want to get it right. And in order to do that, we need to be able to test the models that make those predictions. And to test them, we need something to compare them to, right? And so we have to get the ancient climate right in order to make those comparisons properly. And, broadly speaking, that's one of the things we're after.
If we could go a million years into the future and we could extract an ice core, how would this age that we're living in now appear in the ice?
Well, so that's a loaded question. There's a lot we could envision, and then people have even maybe written stories about this. I'm going to pick one thing that I think is important about this, and that is that, in ice cores, we've learned a lot about the history of atmospheric greenhouse gases. One of the things we know from sort of fundamental, what you'd call carbon cycle science, is that when you put carbon dioxide into the atmosphere, the way we're doing it now, it doesn't go away very quickly. So if we continue to add CO2 to the atmosphere and you had an ice core that covered, say, the next 100,000 years, eventually we'll run out of carbon to put into the atmosphere and then it'll start coming down. But that coming down will happen over 100,000 years. So the ice core record would show about 100,000 years of declining carbon dioxide. And the point of that is that the impact of CO2 lasts for a long time. What else you would see, another way of answering this question is that what happens in the future totally depends on the decisions that we make now. Like the biggest uncertainty about the future is what we do, not about how the system reacts. And so what we're going to read in the ice cores in the future is going to depend on what we do.
Ed Brook, thank you so much for talking to us.
Thanks very much for your interest.
Ed Brook is a paleoclimatologist and professor of Earth, Ocean, and Atmospheric Sciences at Oregon State University. He is a member of the COLDEX team.
Molly, I think these ice cores that Dr. Brook was talking about are so important because they help to explain why the climate for the past 2 million years is unusual in Earth's history. It's largely been long ice ages, like the one I was talking to Hugh about, when that proto-writing was being tested out. That's really quite unusual in Earth's history. 60 million years ago, when the dinosaurs died out, it was really warm. So there's been this long trend of cooling over that time. But obviously, the bit that we're worried about these days is the carbon dioxide levels, and they are shooting up. And again, I think by understanding the past, as recorded in these ice cores, for example, helps us to try and work out what's going to happen in the future with the global warming. But the CO2 levels now are way above what are in those ice cores at all, which is, of course, alarming.
In your interview with Hugh, he said that climate change, this changing climate, puts pressure on humans to adapt quickly, that climate is driving evolution. But also what we're taking away from Ed Brook is that human cultural evolution is driving climate.
Well, that's a really interesting one. I've heard this before, that the climate became so changeable in the past 2 million years. The thing that drove human evolution, the idea that we needed to be intelligent to plan, was the changes were happening too fast for normal sort of physical evolution to work out. So being adaptable, being able to plan, being able to work out, oh, I'm going to keep the water there, being able to move between savanna and forests was sort of what drove our intellect. But as you say, Molly, that intellect then gave us the rise of modern human behavior and the cars and the factories. And we are in charge of climate now. It's not the, it's completely the reverse of 2 million years ago.
Next, there's a common denominator to everything we've been talking about so far. It is literally the bottom. Everything has taken place on a bed of rock, and it too has tales to tell about our ancient past.
Rocks are actually quite fascinating, and if you're prepared to sort of spend a bit of time looking at them, they actually are a window on a world that you would never knew existed.
Coming up, we rock out with geologist Simon Lamb, as this episode of Big Picture Science continues to go old school. Our planet has been around for a long time. It was formed an almost unimaginable 4.5 billion years ago from the accretion of dust and gas particles. Once in planet form, but still molten, it spent hundreds of millions of years cooling off. During this time, the planet was rife with volcanic activity and under constant bombardment from comets and asteroids. It was hostile and inhospitable. So when did Earth turn into a blue planet that could support life? Victoria University of Wellington Earth scientist Simon Lamb finds clues to that question in ancient rocks, and his research takes him to South Africa, where he studies and treads on some of the planet's very oldest rocks. They are 3.5 billion years old. He describes what that's like.
When I first visited these very ancient rocks in southern Africa, to be quite frank, I was sort of blown away by it, because I suddenly realized I was essentially walking on a fragment of the Earth's surface that formed about a quarter of the way through its history. But once you actually start looking at the rocks, you actually realize that they're just like rocks that could have formed in our recent geological history. And actually, after a while, you very quickly forget that they're incredibly old, and you're just sort of totally absorbed in what they're telling you about the Earth, and you just enjoy the story. And that's basically what has been my experience looking at these very ancient rocks.
It's natural to think chemistry held the reins directing life's first appearance on Earth, but our young planet's geology was as instrumental to its emergence. It provided the physical structure and energy that allowed chemicals to combine. The oldest rocks on Earth, A Search for the Origins of Our World, is Dr. Lamb's book, and our first question for him provides a bedrock for understanding the crucial role geology played in giving life a foothold. What exactly is rock?
Yeah, well, a lot of people ask that question, and it's a sort of a question that sort of every geologist sort of has to answer. And when I was writing my book, I was very conscious that if you use the word rock, people immediately are turned off. It sounds immensely boring. But actually, rocks are actually quite fascinating. And if you're prepared to sort of spend a bit of time looking at them, they actually are a window on a world that you would never knew existed. And basically, they're just the foundation of our world. You know, everything underneath the landscape, underneath the biosphere, that is everything created by life, is rock. And so that they are, our world is built on rock. We live on rock. And what's interesting about it is how it actually came to be there, how it formed. And if you can understand that, then you actually have the key to cracking a code to understanding the history of our planet.
Well, Simon, there are only a handful of sites in the world that have outcroppings of the oldest rocks. And those are rocks that are dating between about 3.5 and 4.4 billion years old. Is the reason that these sites are so rare is that they needed to have survived billions of years of recycling driven by plate tectonics?
So you will only find ancient rocks in the heart of the continent. I mean, what's special about the area where I worked, which is in southern Africa? It's in actually a small African kingdom called Eswatini. It used to be called Swaziland. Is the rocks there have actually stayed at the surface of the earth ever since they formed. And that's extremely unusual for that to happen. So in many places you will find ancient rocks, but they've been through this incredible process where they've been caught up between colliding plates. They've been taken down to great depth. They've been heated up. They've been subjected to huge pressures inside the earth. And they've changed in their nature. And then eventually, through some other collision of plates, they've been brought back up to the surface. They're not the same rock that formed on the surface, right back when they originally formed. There are actually only two places on the planet where you can find rocks from the very early part of the planet's history that have stayed at the surface. One is in, as I was saying, in Eswatini and the adjacent parts of South Africa. And the other one is in Western Australia, a place called the Pilbara. And it's really these two places that are where you find them. And so they're a sort of mecca for geologists wanting to study the early history of our planet.
Well, let's get to what you've learned from studying the rocks in South Africa, because indeed the very oldest rocks, those that are 4.4 or 4 billion years old, are in Canada or Australia, as you mentioned. But your focus is on slightly younger rocks by 500 to 800 years in South Africa in an area called the Barberton Greenstone Belt. And presumably you're studying these rocks because they've been less altered and they've been easier to interpret. As we said, that's a rare field site to have this rock that hasn't been changed, altered in some way. So Simon, can these 3.5 billion year old Barberton rocks provide you with a picture of what the Earth looked like then? I should say with a clear picture of what the Earth looked like then? And can you paint that picture for us?
Well, if you go back to, say, 3.5 billion years ago, which is the early part of the record that's preserved in the Barberton Greenstone Belt, you're basically looking at a world of oceans. So you have to imagine a world where a planet which is mainly covered by water, and then sticking out of that water would be volcanic islands. And these islands would be volcanically very, very active, very, very explosive, highly dangerous eruptions that are a sort of could go off at any time. So in the early part of the record, you'd be actually quite restricted in terms of where you could be on land. But of course, if you had a submarine, you could then roam around underwater. And what you'd see there is the seabed would look actually very like sailing around in the floor of the Pacific Ocean. So it's essentially an underwater volcanic landscape that erupts underwater. But in amongst that, you will find rocks that clearly formed above sea surface. So for instance, you'll find evidence for bubbling mud pools. That's one of the most extraordinary things that we found in Barberton, is that you actually, if you go to a geothermal area, you will see where hot gases and water come to the surface. You get these bubbling mud pools and geysers. Well, they leave a very distinctive sort of signature of their activity. And you can see that in the rocks in Barberton. And also, extraordinary, you'll find sitting on some of these lava flows, you'll find algal mounds, which we call stromatolites, which are basically where life is sort of thriving, growing on the volcanic lavas. And these mounds There are a few places on Earth today where they form, and they tend to form in very shallow intertidal waters. So you have the signature of deep underwater eruptions, and you also have in amongst it the signature of shallow water or out of the water on land deposits.
So in your wonderful description of the early Earth, this would have been about 3.5 billion years ago, you jumped ahead of the story just a little bit because you mentioned algae. So at some point, life emerged. And Simon, how did young Earth's geology allow for the emergence of life?
Okay, well, basically life is, you know, made up of elements like anything else. And it's made up of the elements that were in the original solar nebula, which clumped together to form our planet. So if you like, the ingredients of life are the ingredients of rocks or part of the ingredients of rocks.
Are you about to say that we're all stardust?
Yes, we are all stardust. But we are sort of a particular component of the stardust, which is basically carbon, oxygen, hydrogen, nitrogen, and there are some other key elements. And you'll find all those elements in the oldest rocks that we know about. I think that as you start to form a planetary surface, the same sorts of processes are going on, which is basically generating very violent eruptions of ash and putting lightning strikes through it. So basically, you know, a bit like most people's idea of how the Frankenstein monster was created.
So that would have provided maybe some of the energy.
Yeah, exactly. And that's another aspect of the rocks in the that I studied, is that you can see evidence for incredibly violent, explosive volcanic eruptions. And where we've witnessed those eruptions in modern times, and for instance, there was an eruption in 2022 in the Pacific, the Hunga eruption, where we actually witnessed one of these very, very explosive underwater eruptions that burst out of the ocean and actually went into space. We could see what actually happens, and you basically get an ash cloud which is turbulent, and also there's an enormous amount of static electricity in it, triggering lightning strikes. And in the Hunga one, over 11 hours, there were 200,000 lightning strikes sort of going through this eruption. And it's that sort of those are the sort of conditions that will constantly be creating the biochemistry of life.
What's interesting about that is I thought that maybe the volcanic activity made the early Earth inhospitable, but you're saying that some of that volcanic activity and some of that energy was actually needed to help give life a foothold.
Absolutely. And, you know, what may seem inhospitable to us in terms of, you know, we're complex organisms with many, many cells, is not the same as what's inhospitable to a singular cell, you know, a microbe in the early stages of life. So you can go to, it's very hard actually to go anywhere on the planet today and not find life. And so that, you know, a volcano has within it many, many environments, or what ecologists call niches, where microbes can survive. So I think the earliest forms of life lived very close to where that biochemistry was being created. As the process that creates volcanic eruptions eventually creates the rocks that form the continents. So over time, as the plates move around, these small islands start to, they change in their chemical nature. You start to get the type of rocks that form the continents, what we call granites. And then over time, these coalesce to form larger blocks. And so we have small microcontinents that I always imagined something about the size of Newfoundland, something like that, small continental areas. And then the shores of these islands would be less volcanically active and would provide a more stable environment in which microbes could start evolving.
Do you think that life took hold quickly? Do you think that life began quickly? And what is quickly to you?
Let me preface everything I'm saying by this is all highly controversial. So this is my view from studying these very ancient rocks, but it's not to say that everybody will agree with me on this. But my view is life started very quickly. And what I mean by that is it started within the first few hundred million years of our planet. And to give you a sort of an analogy of that, it's a bit like saying, if you imagine an 80-year-old woman saying that sort of that everything, her personality, everything about her that sort of gives her her character started when she was a toddler, so in the first few years. So basically all the main features of our planet, and I would put these into water, life, and plate tectonics. And I actually argue that you need all three of these operating to preserve life. All start, and you need all of them together. So if any one of those went, the others would eventually go as well. All that came together in the first few hundred million years. So it all started very, very quickly.
Simon, I want to get at the fidelity of the geologic record. Earlier in this episode, we heard about the research of 40,000-year-old writing, which is probably the earliest example of human writing. And that feels quite ancient to us. Of course, it's not when compared with geologic time. Yet in your book, you make a fascinating comparison between the accuracy of the historical record or the archaeological record and the geologic record, which is much older. And you say that the latter, the geologic record, is much more reliable than the historical record. And how so? Help us understand that.
Well, it's something that fascinated me is how good the geological record is. And, you know, if you're a historian or an archaeologist, the actual amount of information that you have to work with is surprisingly small. You know, people think that in human history, humans can talk to each other. When you had the development of writing, people could write it down and preserve it. But actually, the amount of information that people have written down is absolutely tiny compared to what's happened. And so the geological record is formed by major events at the surface of the earth. It could be a huge period of flooding, a very large earthquake, a massive volcanic eruption. That actually is imprinted in our bedrock. It actually generates processes and material which then gets fossilized as rock, and of course life gets fossilized as well. It's the sort of direct recording of the event.
For one, it's not filtered through the human mind. It's the direct recording.
When something happens at the surface of the earth that sort of creates strata, then it will be a very faithful record of what happened. But there will be gaps in time between the next event that creates the next lot of strata. So I'm not saying that the geological record is continuous on a human time scale. It's just that when it does form, it's very, very complete. I think the problem with the historical record is that it has to be filtered through a human recording it, and that process of recording by a human leads to something that's very, very incomplete. And actually, as you go further back in time, it becomes so incomplete that you just get very cryptic references to what's happened. So the geological record is snapshots, but I would liken it more like to a photograph. It's like you've got suddenly somebody's taken a photograph of a period in time. And can you imagine what it would be like if you had a photograph of, you know, the Columbus's discovery of America, or, you know, the Romans invading Britain? You suddenly had a photograph of Caesar getting off his ship. The amount of information in that is just phenomenal. And that's basically what the way I would see the geological record. It's a whole series of photographs of our past. So where you have it, it's very, very rich. And there are places in the geological record where the photographs are so close together that you almost run it as a film. So it becomes like a sort of time lapse sequence. And you get these moments in time. That this is the thing that sort of I find absolutely amazing sometimes when you're looking at rocks. You're looking at a photograph of a moment in time. Like, for instance, I've seen rocks in the Barberton Greenstone Belt, which were laid down by rivers. And you can see the surface of the river and you can see the ripples created by the flow of water. And there's been a puff of wind which has blown that water in a different direction and has created a new set of ripples that are sort of at a different direction, and then the river carries on flowing. So you've literally got a photograph of a puff of wind that existed over 3 billion years ago. And it's that sort of level of detail that I think people would be very surprised that geology is and rocks are capable of revealing that. And the more you study rocks, the more you look at them, and people are becoming ever more ingenious at decoding what they contain, they get more and more detail of what the world was like when that particular rock formed.
Well, Simon Lamb, thank you so much for joining us. I've really enjoyed talking to you.
And I've enjoyed talking to you, and it's a great pleasure to be able to talk to somebody about rocks who's actually prepared to listen and take an interest.
Simon, I have a rock-solid attention span. That's the reason. Simon Lamb is an earth scientist and professor of geography in the School of Geography, Environment and Earth Sciences at Victoria University of Wellington in New Zealand. And he is the author of The Oldest Rocks on Earth, A Search for the Origins of Our World. And now we turn to Roland once again so he can help provide us with the big picture perspective of all this ancient talk.
How long have I got, Molly? This is my favourite subject. I've been to those places that Simon was talking about. So I've been to Barberton. I've been to the Pilbara in Australia. I've seen, you know, in Pilbara, I walked on the oldest beach on the planet, about 3.5 billion years old.
Now, what listeners don't know is that in the conversations that you and I have had, and also with the others preparing for the show, almost every opportunity you have held in front of us old rock, and then you would like leave the conversation and run off and try to find another old rock. This is your chance, Roland. How old are those rocks that you keep in your office?
Well, this one I've got holding in my hand, it's one of those stromatolites, these sort of bacterial mats that Simon was talking about. I've got one of those. That's about 2.7 billion years old. So it's relatively young. But it was this enormous chalk reef that was laid in the shallow oceans he's talking about, bathing these microbes, bathing in sunlight in the tropics somewhere, and building great hills all those years ago. That's one of the ones. I have got some tiny piece of material from Greenland where maybe the first record of life is also recorded. There it's just little black flecks of maybe carbon that was once pass through an organism, but that's a more speculative piece of science, that one.
Roland, were you allowed to leave those sites with those rocks and the specks of carbon in your pocket?
These bits are scraps. They're just bits that had fallen off the cliff face and everything.
Okay. So for the record, you did not answer that question.
this stromatolite comes from a roadside where they'd bulldozed away a whole part of the stromatolite reef. So I don't think that was such a big deal.
This show would not be possible without the old-fashioned hard work of senior producers Seth Shostak and Gary Niederhoff, assistant producers Shannon Rose Geary and Brian Edwards, and contributor Sikon Akbon. And a special thanks to science writer and BBC contributor Roland Pease for lending his reporting excellence to this episode. I am the executive producer of Big Picture Science, Molly Bentley. The original music in the show is by Dewey DeLay and June Miyake. And this episode of Big Picture Science that looks at the evolution of life in the context of deep time is called Old School.